Okay, when were we having?
Ready.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. This is, of course, the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is February 23rd. And we are going to be holding a public hearing this afternoon. Before I gavel in the public hearing, Ms. Deister or anybody else, is there anything that we need to handle?
Specifically, I guess I would just say that your meeting materials are on OLIS. They include the LFO overview, a copy of housing slide presentation. There is a report, an interim report, with regard to the CASA program that is included as background for you. And also, the DAS presentation is under today's meeting materials as well.
Excellent.
I have a
question. Just
yes, Representative Whitson.
Because I'm first time on this committee, how do we have no revenue impact from this bill?
That's an excellent question, Representative. Generally speaking, the revenue impacts have to do with those bills that are spending tax revenue, but for budget purposes, the budget bills, we're dealing with the spending side. Is that helpful?
Not really.
but we can ask somebody else again in a few minutes to see if their answer works any better.
Yeah, to me it seems like it's one of the largest revenue impacts in terms of distribution of money from the state.
A lot of the dollars that you see, Representative, have to do with non-limited funds, and those are from housing indentures and bonds that are issued by Housing and Community Services. The general fund of Housing and Community Services budget, the current service level general fund is relatively small. It's about $20 million, or 13.2 is the current service level. So those would be the dollars that would be realized, if you will, from income tax revenue, liquor fund revenue, and those types of sources.
I'm just trying to understand that.
Indeed.
What we call revenue or impact, you know, revenue impact or whatever. So thank you.
All right. Well, looking around the room, there are a few people that aren't here yet. I think some of them are on their way. As far as I know, nobody is AWOL. Everybody is excused. But we'll start with that presumption unless we hear otherwise. I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5513, Housing and Community Services Department. Ms. Van Vliet, would you like to come up and bring your entourage with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Margaret Van Vliet, and I am the director of the Housing and Community Services Department. Very glad to be here today and share the budget presentation with this committee.
Well, welcome. Nice
Thank
to
you.
See both of you. And would you like to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record as well? And
sure. Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tamara Brickman with the Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office.
Excellent. So I think we have a lot of slides today.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have 88 slides to get through today and tomorrow. So I will do my very best to get through them quickly and not dwell on the ones that are perhaps less relevant and just background, and try and allow time for the ones where I know there's likely to be more interest.
You're fine.
Please, go ahead.
So by way of quick reminder, for those of you who had heard this story 2 years ago, when I was before this committee 2 years ago, it was to present to you the concept that the agency had been asked by the governor to take a deep dive look into our programs, our service delivery model, our community partnerships, and our fiscal sort of underpinnings. And so we have spent the better part of the last couple of years really embarked on that. And so I want to touch on some of the highlights from that as we go through this afternoon. And then that sets the stage for what's in the budget. So folks may recall that the four key recommendations came out of this deep dive transition planning work that the agency undertook. And they're recapped here to refocus the agency, and I'll talk more about that as we go through the afternoon, to redesign policy and governance. And there was a particular set of circumstances that have driven the agency over its history that we'll talk more about as well. The idea that we need to really infuse mutual accountability top to bottom, and then drive alignment of our work with the other work in state government. So I'll touch on those themes as we go through the day today. But to just dwell for a minute on this piece about refocus the agency, this is partly about streamlining our functions, but also about reorienting us to become more of a facilitator of local and regional prosperity efforts than we have perhaps historically. There was a point in time when the question was, should the agency disband? And we, through our process, really answered that and came back to the conclusion that no, that's probably not helpful. We should have an agency, but it really does need to be refocused, and so we've been on that journey. We need to better understand our fiscal model, our financial underpinnings, and as we go through the budget, you'll be reminded that we have a fairly complicated budget, lots of funding sources, and so that continues to be a focus. And some of these other pieces around just really getting the agency to be as high-performing as possible. The other question that had come up was whether or not the agency should perhaps take a step outside the executive branch and be semi-independent or independent. Again, I think we answered that and came back to this subcommittee in February of 14 with the recommendation that that probably would not be helpful to the accountability question and the alignment issues. As we've gone through time, we did take the opportunity to refresh our vision, mission, and our unique value that we provide within state government on questions of prosperity. And so I won't read the words to you here, but they're here for you. This is not a radical departure from how the agency has seen itself in the past, but I think there's a nuance here that is important, and that is that we really see ourselves in service to broader goals around prosperity, economic independence and prosperity for all Oregonians, particularly those with lower incomes, and that our particular piece within that is around housing and providing housing resources and providing leadership around housing issues. This question of unique value, I think, is an important nuance, and it's helping us as we work to really refine the culture. Is we are uniquely suited to really bring this statewide clarity and focus around housing stabilization in that broader context. Again, through the transition process and lots of community engagement, we came to see that these two goals were really intermingled. One, to help the state achieve economic security for all Oregonians by strengthening the housing system and integrating our policy outcomes, but at the same time, continue to focus on serving the greatest possible number of low-income Oregonians as effectively as possible within that system.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Yeah, yes, Senator Johnson.
I guess I would like to just begin to build a little bit of a record. When you're talking about the housing side, it not just low-income Oregonians, although I think that there may be a subset, but I also would encourage all of us to think about those subsets that may be living in poverty but have unique problems with respect to mental illness, with respect to living productively with disabilities, veterans who I think sometimes we focus so much on the low income, we forget that there are these other niches that would profit very much from having a stable housing.
Absolutely. Very good. Thank you, Senator. Point well taken. I think this slide begins to touch on some of what you're describing, and it is this idea that while the agency and our work inside state government, we were doing sort of a deep examination, we did see that nationally, many sort of think tanks and foundations and others were also doing deep research around the impact that stable housing has on multiple populations, including, for school children and academic performance, including in the healthcare arena, and and certainly also in the corrections arena, and the idea that ex-offenders, if stably and safely housed, are much less likely to reoffend and to become contributing members of society. And so I paint that picture just to sort of underscore that idea that housing does touch many other systems, and we recognize that, and it is very much part of the conversation nationally. I also think that this helps underscore the kind of the way we see ourselves and the way the agency is trying to position itself around improving the lives of more Oregonians, recognizing the foundational role of stable housing and the impact it can have on these other systems, health, education, safety, and economic security. I thought it was important to just remind some of you or introduce you for the first time to these kind of characteristics of our desired future state. These are just a few of them that we worked on very carefully with both our employees and our partners. It's sort of a guiding principles exercise. If we're going to rethink the agency, what do we want it to look like in the ideal future state? And so it's these questions of it should be effective and aligned, that we should be very clear about how costs are matched to available resources. And if we're going to subsidize something, cross-subsidize something, let's be very intentional and transparent about that, and so forth. I think there's another theme in here which we'll come back to, which is we really want to drive to push our resources as close to our customers as possible, and that's important because the agency does not do direct service delivery. We work through partners, and we want to work to empower them more.
Senator Johnson.
A comment, and then I'm going to ask you to reflect on my comment. I think when you undertook in the last biennium this period of thoughtful introspection, that there was a lot of angst on the part of partners, and I heard a lot about it. In the interest of full disclosure, my husband sits on the board of our community action team, and I have occupied that seat. And it is my observation that that is calming, and that folks are now feeling a sense of kinship and partnership with the agency in moving ahead to try to deal with some of our common issues. Could you reflect on that for the benefit of the committee, particularly our new colleagues?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson. It's been a very interesting journey and trying to understand their interests and their perspective as direct service providers, particularly in community action agencies, but I would say the same is true with nonprofits who do housing development and housing and are owners or landlords of multifamily housing. It was pretty threatening to many partners, the idea that the agency, maybe we should disband it, that there was enough of a fiscal question at hand and enough worries about is the service delivery model really as effective as it could be, and that was threatening. And some of you will recall that I had a chart I fondly referred to as the spaghetti chart, which showed all the multiple decision makers and the advisory body and the way it was very complicated for local actors to access our resources. So I think it was both heartening to recognize that we've made it hard for them historically, but it was threatening to them as well. And so I think we have worked really hard to sort of rebuild kind of an understanding and those relationships. I think that continues to need to be a point of focus. We can't know everything sitting in Salem running these programs. We must defer to folks who are expert on the ground at serving people who are struggling in poverty. So I remain very committed to that.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. We've been on a long path on this thing since I was chief of staff for Senator Whitsitt. And so one of the primary concerns that I had, and I just want to understand if I'm understanding we've worked through this, that can you identify individuals or groups who may source funds from multiple funding sources? I remember the spaghetti chart, mm-hmm. and we were looking at, could we tell if person A or entity A was getting money here and money there and money there? Do you have a way to tell an integrated system where everybody's at, that someone isn't, or a group or whatever, sourcing multiple fund sources, if you will, without the knowledge of the other fund source.
Yeah,
I know you know what I'm talking about. Everybody else,
Mr. Chair and Representative Woodsett, to some degree we can see that more clearly today than we could 3 years ago, but I need to say it's not a perfect vision. We still draw data from multiple systems that don't yet talk to each other perfectly. And so at the community level, those who deliver services for us, I think they have a better handle on that than we do sitting in Salem. But I think that needs to be continue to be a point of focus for us, that we're clear about who's accessing resources, how are they moving on in their lives, what other systems of support are they able to access, whether it's you know, food supports or child welfare kinds of resources or workforce kinds of resources. Data systems in state government don't yet talk to each other well, and I think that's part of the journey going forward.
God, that was diplomatic.
I love it.
So as part of all of this, I'll make a brief reference to the fact that we have come up with a new strategic framework to guide the work. I would characterize this as more internally focused, but that we did take all of the learnings over the last couple of years and really formulate them into what we're calling strategic imperatives. And we've carved out these five that we think are really paramount if the agency is going to achieve its vision and its mission and really activate those, you know, desired future state characteristics, that we've got a lot of work to do internally to sort of improve our ability to perform. And so we've got the policy and governance model. We need to think differently about service and our relationship with our community-based partners. We need to better understand and articulate our financial model. I think we need to work on leadership skills and sort of technical skills and leadership skills, I would say, within the agency. And we need to be better about data and research driving our decisions. So we are partway into our first year in implementing what I would characterize as largely, but not exclusively, kind of internal process improvement plans. And I'd be happy to share more about that with any of the members or this committee with time permitting this week or whenever it's convenient for folks. So with that backdrop and sort of how did we get here, let me kind of describe some of the budget drivers and give you an overview of the budget. So this is a more pleasing view than the spaghetti chart was. Well, depending on how you're, it looks slightly more organized. I think it's important to understand our role really in some ways as an intermediary or a public bank. Again, we don't provide direct service delivery. We see very few low-income Oregonians directly served by the agency. There are a few exceptions, but by and large, we are an intermediary. And so what this chart intends to sort of show is we assemble funds from multiple federal and state sources. We package them. We hold competitions for those. And then the money goes back out the door in many ways like a public bank to developers who do housing and deliver different kinds of housing on the ground. And then there is kind of the other half of the house, if you will, which is what we're calling housing stabilization funds. Again, it's we assemble federal and state resources, lots of complicated colors of money inside here, and we're going to go through those today. And then we send those back out primarily, though not exclusively, to community action agencies to be our direct service delivery mechanism. So again, the point of these charts is just to show our place in the broader scheme and our intermediary role. So we'll start looking at a few numbers here. This is really the high-level look by program area. And you can see we have this, it's a very large budget, $1.4 billion, but the majority of that, $950 million, is, as Michelle was saying a few minutes ago, this bond-related and debt service non-limited funds. And so the other safety net, energy weatherization, multifamily, single family, and so on are the other major program areas. And of course, I'll go through those today. This slide shows the budget really by fund type and a relatively small proportion of general fund. And you'll see in a few minutes kind of where that goes. A little bit of lottery funds, but those are for debt service on lottery bonds authorized in previous biennia. A variety of sources of other funds, and then several streams of federal funds.
Representative Whitson.
I was wondering if you could discuss what we've indebted ourselves with in the past. Could you explain so what we're paying interest on now and for how long, what that covered?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsett, with respect to the, I'll go back a slide to the that large number, the 952. Is that what you're thinking about?
Yes.
So that, think of that as it's an indenture. It's a pool of bonds, and we have been granted, actually by the federal government, the authority to issue tax-exempt bonds. And the explicit authority is so that we can make loans out of those bond proceeds for multifamily and single-family housing. And those indentures have been actually large. They're, I think, a couple of billion. I don't know the number off the top of my head. We can get that for you tomorrow. But there's a large outstanding balance in these indentures. And as our borrowers repay us, both on a single-family mortgage and multifamily developers repay their mortgages to us, we turn around and then pay the bondholders. So the dollars you see here really represent money going in and out to pay the debt service on those underlying bonds. Those are not serviced by lottery fund or general fund. Those are serviced by the revenue off of the off the loans. Does that help?
And a follow-up?
I wondered if you have now determined what the foreclosure rate was on that. Last year you didn't have it, and I'm wondering what the foreclosure rate was on those homes that you provided money for that the people aren't paying back.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsett, I'll bring the number tomorrow. I don't have it off the top of my head, but what I can tell you is it's consistent with or slightly better than, meaning less foreclosures, than the private market. So if you compare us to other holders of mortgages in the private sector, our foreclosure rate, our delinquency rate, and our foreclosure rates are right in line or slightly better than, if that helps. But we'll get the
numbers.
We'll get the data.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Could you comment on the kind of reserves that you have on hand to service your bond portfolio?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, that is a great question, and I don't have the answer off the top of my head.
That's so fine. And I
but we do have to have, yeah. So it's prescribed by the trustees, by the rating agencies. These bond issuances are rated, and so there's a lot of regulatory overlay to that, but I don't know what the amount is off the top
follow
of my head.
Up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Let me tell you what prompted my question. The first time that I saw this budget quite a long time ago, I was startled by the high reserves, and I didn't fully understand at the time that you had to have bond reserves, and periodically advocates say, well, look at all the money they've got, why don't they spend some more of this on housing where there's such a desperate need? And I think building a record on what you are legally required to maintain as sufficiency to guarantee the portfolio is important to have on the record.
Thank you. Point well taken. Again, this is by fund type. We'll go through more of this. And this is a view that just shows how much we spend on operating the agency versus how much is in this non-limited, the debt service payments, and then program payments are what go out to partners who do the work for us. Okay. So a reference here for those who followed, worked with me 2 years ago related to the magnitude of kind of the fiscal challenge that was a driver. I won't read this very verbose slide, but suffice to say, we really believe that through a variety of measures, we've been able to get the fiscal challenge under control. I would say to you that we have more work to do to be crystal clear about how we are accountable and how we keep track of all the various grant streams that come in and go out. I do have a new chief financial officer who is with me today, who is well on the path to providing the kind of fiscal reports internally at all levels, both the highest level and the detailed grant administration level, that I think is really going to help us take this to the next level. So I think that's important. I think the other piece is we really have streamlined. You're going to see in the FTE counts that we're smaller. And part of that is because some of the limited duration work associated with foreclosure programs is coming to a close. But we've also been able to cut some staff in the 15-17 budget in our central services area. So a variety of, we've been guarding vacancies pretty judiciously. You're going to see a report on that. But I think a variety of pieces around skill building, system building are helping us get a handle on this. Here's a high-level look at how the agency is organized. And so the one piece, if you're trying to tie this back to how the budget is organized, there are some differences. And so what we've put in the italics in each of the boxes, you'll see, for example, on the left under Public Affairs, it says Central Services. So the program unit inside the budget is shown in italics in case anybody's trying to track that between how the budget is organized and how my employees are organized. There are some differences here. Effectively, I have the six direct reports, and that includes Oregon volunteers. And again, in the 13-15 LAB, we had 150 FTE, and in this one, we're proposing 126. A couple of words about the environment in which we're doing this housing work. For sure, I don't have to tell this committee about kind of the uneven economic recovery across the state. We are seeing a severe and growing gap in the supply of affordable housing. Unmet need is, any way you slice it, pretty daunting. Only one out of four eligible households, eligible by income households, receives federal assistance for their housing, and that's a national statistic. It's getting a little bit worse. And here in Oregon, by our measures, 150,000 households are experiencing a severe rent burden. That means the rest of their household budget is pretty stressed. In some pockets of the state, home prices, rental rates are going up. Vacancies are decreasing, putting more pressure on low-income people trying to find housing. And then the kind of that housing instability is cited by really all the other major systems as a barrier to their achievement of their policy goals, whether that's corrections or the child welfare system or the health system or the mental health system. So, you know, there's a lot of things sort of pressing on the housing system and asking more out of us, if you will. The other thing, as both my charts here and the spaghetti chart reveal, we have concocted a very complex housing system. It's pretty hard to navigate through. And so there's that. These are...
Yes, Senator Johnson.
I guess I do want to touch on that just for a second, only because it's so fresh in my mind right now. I just came from a Korean War veteran's apartment. He's in Section 8, and he's got a number of issues where he keeps flunking inspections, and he's got a whole team of people fighting to keep him in that apartment. I'm trying to figure out, how do we make this less complex? It's one of the questions that I think was a global question put to the agency back when you were in your period of introspection, because it's the notion of no wrong door. And on the ground, I see systems working pretty well. I mean, I was even in contact with Todd Johnson, the head of Section 8, on Sunday. But do you have any thoughts, now that you've been at this for a biennium, about what can we do to lower the complexity, both for people that are developing low-income housing and also the occupants of the units, and especially in terms of the preservation piece of it? It's tied up federally, it's tied up statewide. Are there things that you, given your now earned experience, that you could recommend to policymakers in the legislature that would try to decrease the amount of complexity?
Yes. So, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, thank you. I think the path we're on will begin to make much of that clearer. But because we're so beholden to federal funds, I've been asked, for example, a handful of times, are there waivers we should be asking for? Are there things that we should ask the various federal agencies, whether it's HUD or Health and Human Services or others, to make it simpler? We've complicated a lot of things at the state level, and so I've got a couple of things, and including a bill that would make statutory changes to try and clean up a little bit of it. There's things we can do, and we are actively doing with our partners to rewrite things like administrative rules. We tie up, we impose affordability requirements for varying periods of time. We define income levels in various ways that make it complicated. So I think there's things around the margins we can do. But I think your question is bigger than that, and I would like the opportunity to sort of reflect on that. And
follow up. While you're reflecting, I guess one of the things that I have become a much more keen observer of is the plethora of boards and commissions that advise the state of Oregon across agencies.
Yep.
And I know that all of us welcome citizen participation, but when you add up the number of people that are serving on boards and commissions, it approaches 2,500 people with differing degrees of ability to follow the rules, transparency, all of the rest, that sort of stuff. And as you are reflecting, I don't know whether a more streamlined set of advisors to your agency would be helpful. I know anybody who might lose a spot at the table is going to fight that like tigers, but I just don't know whether or not there is a more thoughtful way of advising the agency and getting that stakeholder perspective. And I'm not asking you for an answer now, but as you are reflecting on lowering the complexity level, whether or not that plays a role.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I actually have an answer to that question.
Oh.
So yes, we have a bill that's working its way through, and you'll see a slide on that in a few minutes, that would very much streamline the advisory bodies that have been charged over time with advising different parts of agency operations. So that bill, House Bill 2442, is making its way through the process. I'm very excited about the fact that that will for sure create a more centralized place for us to have good conversation about what ought to be our policy priorities. I think that will be a key piece. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Senator Monroe.
Hi. You said there's 150,000 Oregonians that are experiencing severe rental burden. What's the appropriate percentage of a person's income that ought to go to housing for them to be, reasonably stable?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Monroe, it's a great question. It's 30% is the standard, and that's established nationally. People debate it from time to time, but it's well-accepted standard. And so if you're paying more than that, you're rent-burdened. If you're paying half of your income or more, which a lot of Oregonians are, then you're severely rent-burdened, and you can understand the math, of course, that when you when you've got a very low wage, paying half of it or more to live in your apartment means you don't have much left over for other, you know, medicine, transportation, any of the other things that we need. So I've got a couple more statistics on that, which I'll show you, but it's an important indicator that we pay attention to in trying to think about how to allocate our scarce resources.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
Yes, I was wondering if you know on the housing subsidies, how many of the people that receive them are, if you've categorized them by disabled, elderly, and those of working age who are not working for some other reason other than disability or age. And would it make sense to consider where they're choosing to live if they don't work? And I'm not talking about the elderly or the disabled, but there are places that are a lot less expensive to live in this state if you don't have a job. But are receiving federal or state money to live, if you understand.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsup, it's a great question, and I know at the local level, local housing authorities do track that question. I don't have a statewide statistic for you. I'll certainly see if I can get one out of the Housing Authorities Association as one important indicator. I can tell you that several years ago when I worked for a housing authority, it was about half and half, but the trend was increasing percentage of elderly and disabled and a decreasing proportion of families who are working age or working eligible. So, but I don't know the current statistics, and I think it is a relevant question. So we'll see if we can get that for you. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Another indicator of need is the how many Oregon households are considered extremely low income. That number is 175,000. That's just renter households. There certainly are homeowners who are also extremely low income. And there are just 45,000 units that are priced at a level that would be appropriate for that number of households. So that's a way of looking at the gap in the supply of affordable housing. Another statistic which we want to keep track of is how many school children in Oregon public schools are considered homeless. And that number has been startlingly high, has not dipped down yet. And so you see it's about 19,000 for the last school year. That has ripple effects, as you can imagine, in the school system and for their families.
Excuse me, Director. The definition you're using for homeless for these children, is that the same definition our local schools are using, or do you have a different standard?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it is the same definition that the schools are using. We took this from the Department of Education, and it is a definition that includes people, families who are doubled up, or in what's considered sort of temporary housing. So it's not literal, not all of them are literally sleeping outside or in a car or in a shelter situation, but we do have the breakdown of how many are sheltered versus unsheltered or doubled up. And so, yeah, this is just straight out of the Department of Ed's.
All right, thank you.
And then one more slide here on a look at this severe rent burden question as it impacts various parts of the state. Again, it's 150,000 renter households considered severely rent burdened. And the thing to see about the chart, if you can't discern the numbers, is the darker the blotch, if you will, on the map, the worse it is. And so there is severe rent burden experienced in communities across the whole state, really.
Okay.
So with that, I'm going to go ahead and shift into more description of the programs. I'm going to walk through each of the major program areas, including kind of the big budget numbers, a high-level look at results out of each of those program areas, and the KPMs when there's one attached to the program. And then later in the presentation, we'll go over the policy option packages and some other indicators. Okay. So we start with what we're calling housing stabilization programs. They're also labeled as safety net programs in your budget materials. These are, as the safety net and housing stabilization names imply, really designed as that sort of first step into getting assistance if there's an emergency, the possibility of an eviction, if people are literally sleeping outside. So it's the programs that really help those people at the bottom end of the continuum. It includes rent assistance, rapid rehousing, shelter. We also have, and we'll talk more about this, food assistance programs are clustered in this budget category. We're going to talk about those are proposed. We're proposing to transfer those to DHS in the next biennium because we think they're better equipped to do food policy than we are. But we'll talk more about that. And then there's also a landlord guarantee program inside of this that is designed to help with housing access. And you can see the sort of big numbers that are attached to those major categories. So in the category of homelessness prevention, so I think of this as either ending somebody's homelessness or preventing it in the first place. We have Emergency Housing Account, or EHA, which is both funded by general fund and something called the Document Recording Fee, and the State Homeless Assistance Program. You can see the numbers of folks served through those systems. These systems are primarily operated by community action agencies around the state. In some cases, the community action agency then has a sub-grantee that they work with that's a local nonprofit. In some cases, they're a county government that does subcontracting. And so you can see the asterisks here as well. We served an unduplicated count of about 5,100 folks in this in these programs. So the point there is people fall in and out of homelessness. They might be housed for a minute. They might then fall back into homelessness, or they might enter the shelter, leave voluntarily, and then decide they want to come back inside. So there's any number of scenarios that cause there to be people entering and exiting the system multiple times in a year. We do have a key performance measure that we have attached to this, and I'm going to want to talk probably tomorrow about KPMs and kind of where to take those next with the agency. But for now, this is the KPM we have connected to reducing homelessness. I think the statistic is the right one to track. That is, how many people who enter, who are homeless but then enter permanent housing, remain in that housing 6 months later. That I think is a good thing to measure. The indicator went down, and I need to say that at least part of that, I'm not sure how much, is a data problem. And so here again enters the question of the ability of data systems to talk to each other. And so that's a piece I want to continue to work on. I'm not convinced that the actual number has taken such a dramatic drop, and I get anecdotal information that gives me mixed reviews on that. So we're going to talk more about KPMs. So food assistance programs. So for those of you who aren't aware, a couple of different food assistance programs have been operated by this agency for a number of years. And it includes really the general fund investment, which we call the Oregon Hunger Response Fund, that goes out to the Oregon Food Bank. That's been administered by this agency for several years. And as I think folks know, those are the set of programs that distribute food boxes to Oregonians in need. There are a couple of federal programs attached to this as well.
Senator Monroe.
Those numbers do not include all of the food programs in our public schools.
Mr. Chair and Senator Monroe, that's correct. This is just a very small slice of the food programs that state government broadly administers.
There's an awful lot of schools now, especially in poverty areas, are feeding kids breakfast and lunch, sometimes a snack after school. One of the districts I represent is David Douglas, mm-hmm. where over 80% of the kids are eligible for free or reduced lunch. So that would add greatly to those numbers you're showing in terms of the total food assistance in our state.
Absolutely. And Mr. Chair and Senator Monroe, I think you're making the point very well, and we'll talk about this a little bit later as well. It actually shows up as a policy option package. We think that these programs ought to be better aligned with another agency in state government who is more tuned in to food security policy. We want to get really crisp and smart and savvy about housing policy, housing stabilization policy, and we think that these programs will be better served in the long run if they're better aligned with one of the other major efforts around food security. The SNAP program, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, I think I just butchered that, is also operated by DHS, which is another major source of food security investments by government. And so this, our proposal would to align this with those. We have a KPM attached to this. It's a little bit of a puzzling metric to me. It's measuring the relationship of all donated food to the food purchased by the general fund investment in the Oregon Food Bank. And so I'm not sure that's one that any agency, mine or any others, could actually influence and be an indicator of performance. And so we will hand this off to DHS with our best thinking around this one probably needs to be updated. And so that's a KPM that I am reporting on, but not feeling like it's reflective of food policy.
I would just like to ask the professional staff to flag this if, in fact, it turns out that the committee recommends to full Ways and Means that the food program go to DHS. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I have some concerns about that. We get these agencies that are so big, and I question whether or not they're delivering on their core competencies. But we ought to flag that this is probably not an accurate reflection, whether you have it or whether DHS has it. Because, as you say, there's no way to take agency steps that change the outcome here.
Correct.
Correct. May I?
Representative Whitson.
I was wondering, and maybe it was up there before, how many pounds of food per person do you actually distribute to? Do you know how many people you've distributed to these food items too?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsett, we don't know that. Now, I do believe that somebody from the Oregon Food Bank plans to testify tomorrow in public comment at the conclusion of my remarks to you. So that would be a good, we can look into it, but my guess is they're gonna know it off the top of their head.
Great. Ms. Dyster, you have something?
I just wanted to mention that historically, a KPM related to the Oregon Food Bank has been a pretty difficult one for both policymakers, legislators to kind of try to figure out what is appropriate to measure, and also difficult for the agency. We've tried to change tax on this a couple of times just since this has been my assignment, and we haven't hit the right note yet. So some of it has to do with, obviously, you can move the needle more by the amount of money that's invested, but is that, you know, if what you're trying to figure out is the overall return, it becomes very, very difficult to find a good measure.
Just a follow-up.
Please.
Are the people who receive from food banks required to meet any standard, or is anyone eligible to go pick up food if they feel that they need it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I believe the answer is that there is not an income test or an eligibility test. If somebody needs a food bank, they go to their local food pantry and are able to get a food box, is the best of my understanding. But again, I think my colleagues will be able to address that tomorrow. So the housing choice, let's go back to housing. The Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Fund is a new program. It's connected to the program, the bill passed in 2013, House Bill 2639, which expanded protections under Oregon law to people who have a Section 8 voucher. And that bill, you'll recall, made it mandatory for landlords to accept an application from somebody who has a Section 8 voucher. And so the bill also gave an advisory committee to my department to help stand this program up and to keep track of it. And so that advisory committee, I'm happy to say, is meeting regularly, is doing deep dives into how's it going, the implementation of this law. It's got a good cross-section of landlords, private sector, housing authorities, and sort of tenant advocates, and they're doing, I think, tremendous work in furthering the education of landlords to make sure folks comply with this and people have access. It came with a little bit of money and also asked, the fund was actually funded both by a small general fund appropriation and by a transfer of a different program from my agency into this fund. The way it works is that there's a fund standing behind the tenants and the landlords. If they make, if they rent an apartment and that tenant turns out not to be a good tenant, under certain circumstances, they can make a claim on this fund. This has been in place since July 1st. We've had three claims on the fund and we've paid out not quite $15,000.
Yeah. Representative Nierman, you had a question?
No, that was the answer to my
All
question.
Right.
Thank you.
Very good.
Yeah. So this advisory committee is tracking this really closely, and we want to make sure that if there begins to be a bigger call on funds and there needs to be some policy or budget conversation, that I'm equipped to sort of help shepherd that through. So the next suite of programs is considered energy and weatherization. We also think of this as housing stabilization tools, although they're pointed at reducing folks' energy bills. And you can see here the broad brush numbers. We do get quite considerable funds from the federal government to run these programs. These resources do go out through the community action agencies. They are the frontline deliverer of energy assistance programs and weatherization programs for low-income people. The other funds noted here are public purpose charge funds.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Director. Has anybody done any kind of an analysis about how many programs there are that's doing energy and weatherization? I'm pretty well aware of the CAT stuff, but you've got the public purpose out of the Energy Trust, and they've got their fingers in everything with an almost unlimited amount of money. No bias there. Then you've got Clean Energy Works, and I don't know how much money they dragged out of this session. At one time it was $10 million. I don't know whether it was reduced to $5 million. I just don't remember. But has there been any high-level analysis of how many different programs, what the entry criteria are to get into them? I know for public purpose, for example, you've got to be in a PGE or a Pacific Core customer service area. But is there potential of duplication, and could this be more organized to make for more efficacious delivery?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, people have looked at that. I'm not able to sort of cite that here today. We'll certainly take a look at that. What we are told, especially by community action agencies who do this work, is that they really serve a very different lower income population, and that the Energy Trust programs and the Clean Energy Works programs hit a kind of a middle and upper income sort of a target around energy efficiency and reducing the carbon footprint. So in theory, these programs also reduce their carbon footprint, but I think they also, again, serve to provide some stable housing for folks who are pretty vulnerable. And I believe that there is a legislative report for all public purpose charge, and we contribute to that, and I can't tell you off the top of my head kind of what that what the answer to your question is, but I'm pretty sure there's reporting that would get at what you're asking.
And
so you should look at that.
I'm going to ask the professional staff if they would to refresh my memory about how much we gave Clean Energy Works and whether or not there is an expectation of some kind of reportable ROI, where we're giving that much money to a private not-for-profit, whether or not there is a report back, particularly if they're servicing middle and upper income people. I'm going to ask Ms. Dykstra to run that to ground.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Representative Whitsitt, you had a question?
So this is the governor's proposed budget. So I just want to understand, it's $91 million that would go directly to pay for people's energy bills. Do we know, what was it in 13-14?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, I don't know the number off the top, although I'm sure my staff could get it for you. Effectively, these are kind of status quo numbers, so there's not a proposal to increase or change dramatically either of these line items.
It's probably about a 3% increase in the last
line. I'm getting, I'm not sure if I'm getting information or not.
She says it's $10 million.
It's budget analyst tells me it's $10 million more, and that's probably a combination of federal funds and this public purpose charge.
Could I follow up? How many households are receiving, and what percentage of their bill?
I can tell you that.
Okay, good. And back to the other slide. So, $32 million. Back on the other slide. Is going to weatherization, which you said tends to be higher income people who are applying for programs. Did I understand that right? No.
No, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, all of these programs on my slide are really for low-income people. There is an income eligibility test.
Okay.
What I was referring to was the senator's question around
Energy Trust of Oregon.
Other programs that those monies don't flow through this budget.
Okay, so just to follow up, so I understand. So we're looking at about $125 million going to low-income folks for paying their electric bills and weatherizing their homes, and the next slide is going to show us how many people that are served under that then, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Representative, I'm told this budget is $10 million less than it was in 13-15.
Okay, and I just, if I may follow up on that, the price of electricity has increased also during that time period. So, you know, you may be looking at maybe less, but... we have to consider the price of our energy has increased over the last
2 to 4 years.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, one other sort of point to make is for several years, the agency had an increased amount coming through for kind of stimulus dollars, if you will, ARRA. And a lot of that was in weatherization as a kind of an economic stimulus. So my guess is the fact that it's less this year reflects the wind down of ARRA funds. Mm-hmm. And I have a couple people nodding, which gives me hope that I was right. Okay.
Yes.
All right. And so in terms of how many people are served, here's a snapshot. It's a high number of Oregonians served with these resources. Anecdotally, we know that we serve, Community Action Agencies turn away families, and they cannot meet all of the demand in their local communities. And so it's a pretty impactful program. Both of them actually are. Okay. So that's on the energy assistance. The weatherization programs help fewer, but it's a bigger investment in weatherizing the homes. And here you can see the broad numbers in the recent history. And then we track also energy savings realized from these investments. And we do have KPM connected to these programs, which is sort of for every so there's a little bit of ROI connected to this. I think this is probably a useful measure. It speaks to by how much were folks' heating bills or whether utility bills reduced for every dollar that was invested in their home. And you can see we're a little over dollar for dollar. So now I'm going to touch on the next suite of programs, which is multifamily rental housing. This is also a pretty substantial part of our business. In this, with these suites of programs, this is again where we act like a bank. The money goes, is offered primarily through kind of requests for proposals or funds offerings. We call them NOFAs, Notices of Funds Availability. We package these funds, offer them on a competitive basis, and developers, whether they're for-profit or nonprofit, can compete to use these funds to develop or preserve new housing. I would note that these the dollars here do not include federal or state tax credits, which are kind of substantial in their own right. So in some ways, the investment is not fully reflected here in terms of what goes out on the street. The other point I want to make is that the other funds, which are a sizable proportion of this budget, include both the public purpose charge and the document recording fee. And you'll see a little bit more of a breakdown on that. So in the development and preservation of affordable rental housing, again, this NOFA process is how we distribute these funds. I can tell you that every year we turn away two or sometimes three good proposals for every one that comes in the door. There's community capacity and community need that we cannot meet with even with all these resources. In this part of our work, we also manage some 258 project-based Section 8 contracts that house close to 10,000 low-income Oregonians. We administer those contracts on behalf of HUD, and that those are just ongoing annual renewals of contracts that we just administer. In this arena, we have a couple of KPMs. I think they're probably also could be analyzed for potential updating. But in this first one here, we're looking at how many of the apartments that we finance actually end up housing folks at 60% or less of median income. Right around 80% has been the where we've hit that mark. We try very much to serve that, and almost all of our programs are squarely aimed at 60% and below. So it's not surprising that we hit that mark. We may be able to think of a different measure. And this other measure is all those resources, what's the proportion that go to serve people specifically who are elderly or people with special needs. That number took a dip, and what over time, if you looked at the chart, you would see that it goes up and down and depends on what comes forward to us. Again, since we're responding to proposals, it kind of depends on what comes in the door. So that number varies year to year. And then the third KPM in this arena has to do with construction costs. Now, this is a number that often gets a fair amount of discussion. It has been trending up for many years. I very much believe that it should be tracked, and it is something, of course, legislators and the housing director ought to keep track of. I need to say, however, there's not much I can do about it. And so if we want to think about a KPN, there are many, you know, forces that are sort of environmental in nature, policy in nature. Of course, we want to pay attention to it. I'm just not sure that it's, as an indicator of our performance, is probably as relevant as some other things we might be able to come up with.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Van Fleet, you say you can't do much about that, but I'm looking at the $237 mm-hmm. per square foot. That just seems a little bit high to me. Like I mean, I can build a pretty nice house for. Is what's the driver on that? That you feel like you're out of control? Mm-hmm. Is it acquisition of land? Is it? I don't know.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, it's a great question, and we scratch our heads about it. So, I think there are many factors. For sure, land is one of them. Cost of materials are another one. The quality of construction, the whether or not you pay prevailing wages, whether or not you want it to be a green building and LEED certified at the platinum or gold or silver level. There's any number of things that drive it. We are only a partial funder. And so this is why I'm saying I think we should keep track of it. I think we should press on it. As to whether or not it's something I ultimately have influence on is a different question. I can share with you that nationally, my peer agencies across the country are very concerned about this. So there is national work being done to try and figure out how do we drive cost containment. The other thing I'll share is that Meyer Memorial Trust, which has taken a particular interest in affordable housing, is doing its own study of this question of cost containment, and we're participating in that and trying to be good partners. We certainly want to be aware if there's policies we're requiring in terms of unit amenities or quality or sizes or location that are cost drivers. We should be really clear about that. And I think to some degree we influence it, but for us, it's not really, at the end of the day, we don't actually have control because we're not the developer and there's too many other forces. I hope that helps.
Follow-up?
Right. Then you can have it.
Yeah.
So do you ever do any comparisons of, like, for instance, a private developer who's maybe developing a multifamily thing that's mm-hmm. similar or something like that? How do they come up on that price per square foot?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, we're much higher, and we have looked at that, and that is something that is being studied by this Meyer group, and it's being studied nationally. I don't have it off the top of my head here, but yes, this is higher. And again, I think there's any number of explanations for why that might be.
Yeah. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Whitson.
Yeah, I'd just like to say I think it's doubtful that there is a legislator in this building that lives in a platinum LEED certified home. Maybe there's one, I don't know, but I do have a problem with the fact that we are LEED certifying any sort of public housing.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, your point is well taken. I can tell you that we have dropped the department. Did have some kind of green building standards for a while. We've dropped them so that we can have time to study that question. That said, many of our local government partners still have them. And so even if we say you're not required to do that in order to get our tax credits or our grants, if the local jurisdiction says, no, we want it, and they're putting money on the table, they sort of get to call that shot. And so that's the other piece is when there's lots of layers of money, including multiple layers of public money, we don't call the entire sort of, it's not completely up to us. So there's an influence point there, and I think we have to keep talking about it. And it's a little unsatisfying for all of us, I would say.
And Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know, when you say that, like, as if you're being pushed around by these other municipalities or something like that, I would think the state would be kind of a big player in that. And I would say, if your proposal includes $237 a square foot housing, we will not be doing a program in your municipality. Thank you very much. We'll be doing one over there where they won't require us to be LEEDs Platinum certified or whatever it's whatever it is that's driving it. So, I mean, I'm just, that's kind of frustrating to me. That's just a comment, I guess. You can respond.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nierman, I point well taken, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel compelled to ask a question. Maybe I missed it. Are the costs of energy included in a different slide? There's certainly going to be higher costs, but that's a point in time, and perhaps the costs might be a bit different if the overall cost over time is also considered.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Reed, that is part of the trade-off conversation that happens at the local jurisdiction level. And for those who are very, very much in support of sort of various levels of green building and LEED, that it does drive, that if it's done well, it certainly can reduce operating costs over time. And that's one of the policy trade-offs. So all of these end up being important policy trade-off conversations. So we want to be at the table. We want to pay attention to it. And but I understand the frustration.
Okay, please.
All right. So next I will touch on our single family programs. So in this sort of category of program, we do a variety of homeownership assistance programs, and I'll unpack those just a little bit. We also have what we call the Manufactured Communities Resource Center. Those of you who have been around for a while may know this as the Mobile Home Park Ombudsman Program. And so I'll give you a little bit of data about those. On the homeownership assistance set of programs, funds flow through the agency out to community-based partners to do education, counseling, and down payment assistance. And in addition, through the issuance of tax-exempt bonds, we offer a single-family bond loan program that is slightly more advantageous from a rate perspective than the market rate loans first-time homebuyers can access. We do a variety of things to help people retain home ownership, including a variety of foreclosure prevention programs, and I've got a bit more data on that. And we think that some of the home repair programs that community action agencies and others deliver for us turn out to be a home ownership retention strategy as well. In terms of the Oregon bond loans, this production of about 400 loans per year is low. It's been low for a few years. It was in the thousands in the 8 or 10 years ago. And so we're hoping that to boost that production up here in the next couple of years. We do have a KPM connected to home ownership, and this measures the percentage, the proportion of households who are earn less than the state's median income. And I've had to have folks explain the math to me on this morning. Suffice to say that the bigger the number, if it's a little over one or a lot over one, proportionately, we're serving more people who are of lesser incomes. And so most of our loans go to people who are below median income. And so. The other piece of this is in the foreclosure avoidance program. Some of you will know that there is, in the last few years, a new program that helps homeowners who are facing foreclosure access mediation and also counseling. And so our piece, so the Oregon Department of Justice operates the mediation program, and we send dollars out to local agencies to do the counseling. And so you can see some statistics about numbers of cases resolved. Broadly, what I would say is the 2,200 cases have entered the OFA, the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance System. That's the broad system, both the mediation and the counseling piece. Of those, 1,161, which is the number at the bottom of the pie chart, have been resolved. There's another 1,000 plus that are pending. Of the cases that are resolved, the broad number I would point you to is that half, roughly, were able to retain their homes. So we've got, this is an area where I know that tomorrow some of our homeownership counseling partners plan to talk to you in public testimony about this program. And on the Manufactured Community Resources Center, this is a program where we do both registration, annual registrations for park owners, those who operate mobile home parks, and then also provide dispute resolution. If a homeowner and one of their neighbors or their landlord, the park owner, have a dispute, we have in place a dispute resolution process. This is important for folks who live in mobile home parks or manufactured communities, because once you have your manufactured home, if you're in a dispute with your landlord, unlike if you're renting an apartment, you can't just move. And so it's a bigger deal to be in a dispute. And so this is funded by fees paid to the agency around the registration. Okay. Next area is Oregon Volunteers. In another, for those of you who aren't familiar with this part of the agency's history, in addition to having the food security programs tucked inside the agency, we also have Oregon Volunteers. It's a Oregon Voluntary Commission on Oregon Commission on Voluntary Action and Service. They operate with an independently appointed commission that is appointed by the governor, but for administrative purposes, they're in our budget. And it has three main components, which I'll say a little bit about here in the following slide. So it's Oregon Volunteers and CASA, the Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and also this is where the state's AmeriCorps program is operated out of.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Senator Johnson.
I guess I just want to indicate my concern, abiding concern, that Court-Appointed Special Advocates is still there. It just doesn't seem to be a logical fit. And I know that there was a great deal of discussion early on before they came to housing. Where would they go? And there was a lot of dispute about conflict of interest if they had anything to do with the judicial branch. And so I just think that it's something that needs to continuously be monitored. It is such an important program that to have it have a high profile and to know it's well supported, I think is very important.
Agreed. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson. I've got a little bit more information about kind of what the proposal is for the next biennium, but I think that's actually in the policy option package slides, which we'll probably get to tomorrow. So broad sort of overview of the three sections of Oregon Volunteers, if you will. The generally promotes volunteerism through a variety of means, and including civic engagement. As you know, the CASA is a bit of an anomaly. It was tucked there. I think Michelle referenced that a legislative task force that studied the right long-term home for CASA issued a report, and that is in your materials. And so the upshot of that report is they recommend that they're not ready to be spun out as an independent nonprofit, but with further kind of refinement of their administrative functions, they might be able to, within a couple of years, be independent. So there's still some study going on with that. Uh, Again, I'll come back to that when we get to the policy option packages. The Homeownership Stabilization Initiative, or OHSI, is the program that was funded with federal TARP funds a few years ago. This was when we got $220 million, some of you will recall, to help folks avoid foreclosure. I am glad to tell you that while we had a rocky start, this program has had some real successes, and we are in the process of winding down the programs, and the limited duration staff who've been assigned to this are sort of moving on and finding other jobs. So this is a small, much smaller part of our agency today. I've got a few statistics on kind of outcomes. The program had several different sort of sub-programs. We did mortgage payment assistance for folks who were unemployed or underemployed. We did some refinancing kinds of programs. And then we did something called preservation. And you can see the numbers there. The percentages of retention, as shown on this chart, are actually underreported. And so I want to be sure and underscore for you that the results are much better. And so in the mortgage payment assistance, which is the biggest program, 10,000 people access that program. There's actually 95% of the folks who went through that program are still in their homes after 12 months. So we think that's quite good. And so it's also 95% in the second bucket there, the loan refinance, and it's 98% in the preservation program. The unduplicated number of folks that were served in these programs is 11,620. So that is a huge impact if you think about the numbers of folks who were helped by this federal investment.
Yes, Representative Whitson.
I was wondering on the mortgage payment assistance, if those were loans, if they were repaid or if they were gifted, or where you're at on the repayment of those, whatever.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, the way that worked was we put sort of a lien, if you will, on the home for the dollar amount that we ended up paying. It was 12 payments. We effectively made their mortgage payments for a year to give them a chance to stabilize or gain reemployment. And so if they sell the home, then the money is repaid in their closing. It is forgivable over a period of years. So if they stay in their home for a number of years, then it is forgivable on a pro rata basis.
Director, I'm cognizant that we're a little over halfway through your presentation.
Yes.
We're running out of time this afternoon. I know that we've got some additional business after you're finished tomorrow, as well as public comment. So I just wanted to invite you to find a comfortable breaking point in the next few minutes.
Yeah, of course. I think we'll get there here in a couple of minutes. We're winding through kind of all the program areas, central services. In this regard, we look just like every other agency, director's office, finance, budget, procurement, IT, and the like are in this program area for budget purposes. I want to underscore that we do not devote any sort of general fund to these functions. These functions are paid for with other resources. There's a KPM that is a little unhappy news, if you will, and so I want to address that, and maybe this can be where we kind of sign off the day. As you know, we're required to measure customer satisfaction, and our customer satisfaction by this tool took a big hit last year. And so we want to understand what's behind that and pay attention to it. I would say to you that I think a couple of things were going on. I think for sure the transition process had people confused and worried, and there were probably some lags in responsiveness on the part of my staff. So I think to some degree that's to be expected. One of our strategic imperatives, which I referenced earlier today, is all about sort of delivering remarkable service, that we really have to take this issue seriously sort of as a matter of culture inside the agency, and we're working actively on that. I think there's some other things about designing a survey and being really thoughtful about who it goes to. We have a very large listserv, and just in my scan, span of the survey, I know that people were confused about who was asking. Judging from how they responded, I know we were hitting some people who aren't our customers, but they were responding. So we've got some cleanup work to do, and I'm committed to doing that before I'm back in front of you.
Senator Johnson.
Knowing as little as I know about your survey instrument, I think it would also be safe to say that in the chaos of the mortgage refinancing, there were desperate people that were trying to catch anything that floated by to keep them from drowning. Mm-hmm. And I would clearly understand that if they called the agency and they didn't automatically get a refinance, or they were asked to go to mortgage counseling or credit counseling, that they may have not been happy about that. I welcome your endeavor to clean that up, but I think there were some exigent circumstances, including how uncertain your real partners in delivery were, because I know how many phone calls I fielded, and I know how cranky they were. Yep. And so I'm just trying to say, for the benefit of the committee, particularly people that have not heard this before, that they shouldn't judge that 40% too harshly without looking at all the externals.
Right. Fair enough.
Yes, Senator.
What said on this committee last year as well, and it just seems to me that, you know, for this agency more than any other one, the KPMs don't really seem, either you don't have control over them or the results seem somewhat meaningless. There isn't a good marriage here that I wish we could do. You know, can we do something, I guess?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hansel, we can. And I was optimistic 2 years ago when I was in front of you, and I thought I'd be bringing you new ones today. And I do have a slide, which we'll go over tomorrow. But I would say to you that the bottom line is, if we can really get to a place where we're driven by data and research, and we have a high-functioning, overarching policy body, we're going to be in a very different place. We're going to be able to say, what do we want to invest in? How will we know if that's successful? And how will you measure that? And then that ought to inform things like KPM. So I'm very committed to doing a refresh on that. Again, I was overly optimistic, I think, a couple of years ago. But we're putting in place the pieces that I think will help us have a more intelligent conversation about that. And so I look forward to doing that.
Any other questions?
Director? Mr. Chair, perhaps that's a good place to end by my watch. It's 4:30, and
right.
I think we could pick up on slide 51.
Well,
tomorrow.
We will wait anxiously for part two of your presentation.
Very
and
good.
I thank you for the first 50 slides and for all of our questions. So I'm going to conclude the public hearing. Anything for the good of the order before we adjourn? Then we will take this up again tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Thank you, everyone.
Okay,
we are adjourned. Then we will take this up again tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Thank you, everyone.
Okay,
we